A friend of mine was quite sick and in the hospital, and I was expecting to get word that he'd be passing on, and so forth, and I wouldn't get away from my radio too awful far, but I had to go up to the lake, to the Healy Lake. Well, this Healy Lake, going up the little Healy Creek, is quite, it takes a little skill to do so. And then to get out of that lake, I could hardly get out of that lake in the daytime, in the daylight, and find the channel and watch for it and get out of there. Well, I was up there quite late, and it was getting quite dusk, you know, and I happened to think, you know, something just seemed to tell me to get back to that radio or something. And so I took out just as hard as I could go, and you know, I went right through the mouth of that creek and never hit the bottom or nothing or anything like that, just like that there. I couldn't have done it in the daytime. And I got down just in time to hear that the wind cone was very low and wasn't expecting to live. Well, I just turned my boat around and shut off the radio, and I took off in the dark right up the Tanana River, and I can't go to the Tanana River in the daytime hardly, and I went right up that Tanana River just as hard as I could go, and I never hit a log or a sandbar or anything else, and it's the hardest and the trickiest river you ever seen up in this part of the area here. There was something, and I made it in time to... made contact with the road there, and I was in time to get him.
And who was this, Stan?
Huh?
Who was it?
Well, it was just an old friend of mine here that I'd done carpenter work and listened to things.
Yes, a very dear friend.
So, very good friend and so forth. But something must have been just guiding me as it was, you know, that you couldn't have done it otherwise if I wanted to. No.
Yeah, Stuart Edward White, he wrote at one time on subjects of sort of psychic phenomena, and he made a remark that there men have a special higher faculty. He said that if you are going through a forest at night, sometimes unconsciously this thing takes over and you step over logs that you don't see and things like that. So... whether it's an outside power or something within us, it's hard to know, but there is certainly something that...
There must be. There's no doubt in the world.
Well,
things that do happen.
Go on and tell me now about there at Healy Lake. You had the trading post for how long?
Well, I had that for about 3 years, I guess. Uh-huh. Anyway, it come to an end. It was just about the time when the war started, you see, just a few years before that. Before the war, nothing ever changed up there. It was just the same all the time, you know. It was just the same, the old log cabins and people living into them just like they lived for the last 50, 60 years, you know, and so forth. But after the war, everything just changed and went more modern. We're getting to be more like the outside all the time and everything. But I was right at the place where I went hunting with this little Indian fella, and... we were on our way back from hunting with our moose, and we had to go ashore and camp overnight. It was kind of snow on the ground a little bit. I got in my sleeping bag, and he got into whatever he had to sleep in, and so on and so forth. But this is kind of a comical thing, you know. Anyway, I went off to sleep. Pretty soon somebody was shooting. Oh, my... He was 22, I think it was, and I woke up and I says, "What's the matter, Frank? What you shooting at?" "Oh, me shoot that owl. He sit there and talk bad about me all night long." I kind of laughed. You don't know. He says, "He know my blood." He says, "The moose, he's my blood and everything." But they believe them things, you understand?
Now, what did he mean by that? Could you tell me more about it?
I don't know, but he just...
The moose is my blood, he said.
Yeah, well, they eat moose all the time, you know. That's moose meat, he says. That animals all... They know me, I know that. So forth.
Did you ever hear any of their stories while you were there?
No.
Do you remember any of them?
No, I didn't. They lived quite a ways away, and they would come down and buy things, you know, and so forth. Oh, I probably did, but I can't remember some of the little things.
Did you ever go to any of their potlatches? Or?
No, I never did. They would have a potlatch that would be way up there, and I never went up to their potlatch. I don't think I've ever been to one of their potlatches at all, but I know how it's carried on and how they do it and what they do it for and all that.
Well, did they buy things from you for the potlatch?
Yes, they do. They just buy and buy. Someone has done some good for some one of the Indians, you see, at one time, and he owes them, the village, a potlatch. And so he puts on a big doing. He buys this and he buys that and he buys all these things. We're saving them all up. So that when he has his potlatch, he gives us all to these people and gives it all away. He gives everything he has practically away. Pay out the debt. Well, then pretty soon there'll be someone of the others who'll have to do the same thing because he owes a debt to them for something that they've been doing.
And in a sense, this keeps goods in circulation. To some extent, it keeps goods circulating.
Yeah.
Well, when you went out hunting with these different fellows, did they have any particular way of hunting?
Well, they're quite skillful, all right. There's no getting around that there, and they know where the game is and such, but they would hunt practically. I wouldn't notice whether they did or not. I'd been out in hunting in the same way they were and learned the same way. They it seemed like that they were hunting the same way I hunt and everything else, you know. At the time, probably they to somebody that was new would say, yes, they did. But they're not as skillful as you would think they would be when it comes to trapping and so on and so forth. They don't study it as much as you as a real trapper does, you know, and so forth. Yeah, because they don't really go into it for making a big stake. They just go to get one when they can and so forth and such. I don't know if they ever do show any great skill in anything because, well, game has been quite plentiful for them at all times and so forth. And they know just about where to go to get it and what they can get here and there and so on and so forth. In the early days, before the white man took over so much and everything, the Indian people were more like nomads, you know. They moved from place to place, and they didn't get TB like they got after the white man came here. They would stay in one camp for a while to get their ducks and their fish and so on and so forth, and then they move out to someplace else to get their other meat or their other supplies or something in another part of the country. This would be fumigated, you see, and maybe through the winter be freezed out, froze out, and so on and so forth. And they didn't accumulate a lot of garbage and different things around, you know. They were never sanitary in any way, shape, nobody had ever taught them, you know. They would put their outhouses right above their drinking water and every other thing, you know. After they were taught how to do these things, why they didn't tell them everything that this would be known, you know, and so on and so forth, and they would do things wrong. But then they started schools for these Indian people, you know. White man did, and then they had to stay in the village, in that one village, for a length of time and make that their home. Well, they just kept getting dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, and they never did get fumigated out in any way, shape, or form, and TB took a hold of them. And from that time on, the TB got a very good start in the country. But it's pretty well arrested now, and I don't think that there's so much of it because they can control it now. They can give you a certain kind of medicine to calcify the TB that's in you, and it don't break out. There's not much chance of it breaking out anymore and so forth.
Stan, as a trader, did anybody ever say anything about the way they used to trade? The old trade routes to the coast or north-south or any whatever?
No.
Through the mountains?
No. We know how the Fairbanks was started by a trader. He just came in here and
I was thinking of the old Indian trade routes, because you were, really,
No, they used to travel quite a lot, the Indians did themselves, and trade. They're even mixed up. Some of them would be married to some of them from down Fort Yukon up here, you know, and so on and so forth, because they'd go all the way by boat down, you know, back, and so on and so forth. They didn't have any power in them days. It would be a long trip for them when they did do them kind of things. And they were mixed up with some of the Salt Jacket people, and so you'll hear them say, that's my sister, that's my brother, that's my aunt, they're all related, you think they would be anyway, the way they talk and everything and so forth, and such as that. And so they did travel from one village to another, to the other Indians and so forth like that. And at one time they were quite warring outfit too, as they claimed. The people up in the Scotty Creek up in there was a bad bunch of Indians. They said, that's bad Indians. All we want fight. All we want war. All we want fight. Like white man.
That's what the Tetlin people would say.
That's what the Mahili, Healy
Indians. The Healy Lake people would say.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they had the things that, they're stick Indians. Them were stick Indians. I says, what do you mean by the stick Indians? Well, you come along the river, he says, you lose your baby, you lose your child or something in the river or something like that. Maybe they run away with your child, he says. They hang their clothes on the stick. Like that. So we call them stick Indians. Well, that happened probably. You don't know. Maybe way back years and years before, it never happened. All my time, never seen any of it or anything like that, but it hadn't been passed on to a different one, and so that's a stick Indian, you know.
I've heard
well,
of
anyway,
stick Indians, yes.
I was talking to one of the Indian boys, and he was telling me, he says, I would go down the river, he says, and I get into a bad place, he says, and I couldn't get out of there. That stick Indian, he pulled my boat, he just pulled me right into that bad water, and he tipped me all over, and I lost all my stuff, and I almost got drowned. Now, he figured that the stick Indian was doing that to him. You understand?
It was a spirit, actually. He thought it was a...
Well, that must have been, you know.
The spirit of
the
stick Indian.
The stick Indian was doing it.
Of course.
And the difference of time that they would tell you stories about the stick Indians and so forth. And they called us people up in the Scotty Creek country the stick Indian because they were bad Indians.
Now, somebody told me a story that he said that he had a lot of Indian friends, and one woman made him a pair of mukluks. And he had headed out over the hills, and some Indians caught up to him and came into his camp at night, and he had a feeling they didn't have good intentions toward him. But they stood and talked to him for a while, and then suddenly one of the Indians looked down at his feet, saw the mukluks he was wearing, or his moccasins, and said to his friends that something in Indian, and they took off and they left the man. So the next day the man got into a trading post or an Indian camp over on the other side of the hill, and there he was told that how lucky he had been because he had these moccasins on that said that he was a friend of the Indians. And he said that was the first time that these fellows hadn't robbed him. They'd been trailing him to rob him, but when they saw his moccasins they left him alone. And he said, then I found out that if you were a bad guy and you were not a friend of the Indians, then there were certain designs that indicated to watch out for this guy. And they'd give you a pair of moccasins or gloves or gauntlets or something, but they would really have a design that was a warning to other Indians. But if you were a friend, it meant you could trust him, then they would put the flowers or something like that on there.
Well,
did you ever hear this?
That could have been, because when the people were traveling over the Chilkoot Pass and things like that, they had trouble with Indians in those kind of ways and so forth. I read, and I don't know how authentic it was, but it should have been true because it's supposed to have been true to life, stories of the travels across there and how they had trouble with difference of Indians and so on and so forth. But all the time I've been in Alaska, I have never heard any of that. I've never run on to any Indian people that were that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever I've been on the trail and come upon to an Indian, he was just as friendly as he could possibly be, and a great help to you in any way, shape, or form at all times. I never heard of anything like that at all. And if they did have that trouble with them, I think probably they were aggravated by somehow or the white man to do it, because wherever I've been, there have been the friendliest people. As I say, you were king when you came to one of their places. You ever left without them giving you a whole lot of things, and I never had no ever heard of anything being designed or anything that would do anything like that. It could be in some part, maybe some parts of Canada or something like that. Maybe a different kind of Indian.
Well, this could have been...
When you get back into Canada, well, you're getting closer to the Indians from the States, too.
Well, this was supposed to have been up here. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I asked a woman over in Whitehorse about it, and an Indian woman there. She said, I don't know. She said, it seems like one time I heard my grandmother say something like that, but I don't know. You know, and that's the closest I've ever come to hearing anything about it, but I've never heard it authenticated. And I've talked to a few Indians in this area, and none of them had ever heard of it. So it might have been just one band over on the Yukon or something.
When the pilgrims and the early people in the early days came to America, the Indians were their best friends at all times, and they taught them this and taught them that about the country, and they were all that there, and they stayed their friends for maybe 100 years or more, as it could be, until the white man started to finding gold here and gold there and different minerals and so forth, and running the Indians out and running them off and so forth. The white man brought it on to himself. They're the ones that aggravated the Indian to where the Indian, don't give me too much now, that's plenty, thanks. And that's what made the Indian madder and meaner and so forth. And they're getting the same way here now, understand? It's going into the same way, and we're going to have to watch it very close. They're going to have to watch it very close. The Indians are getting to where they're, they figure they're getting the bad deal. They're the ones that have been to school and so on and so forth. They can understand what the white man has been doing, what they're trying to do, and then they're getting the bad end of the deal, of the laws and everything else, you see. And it's going to be the white man that is, you see in the West there, why, if there was gold or coal or whatever was found in that man's hunting ground or in the, everything, they'd push the Indians off and made reservations, and then they'd take the reservations away from them because they found more gold in that pond from someplace else, and they kept on until they had the Indians so aggravated that they were killing off the white man and everything. The white man brought it on himself. The Indian didn't start it in any way, shape, or form. It was the white man that started it. On the railroad, when the railroad went through there and everything else, it was a white man that was aggravating the Indian people until they got them so they were just hated the white man, understand? And that's just what's going on here. Now you see what happened down here at this place going toward Live and Good, where the
Manly Hot Springs?
Not Manly, but the other...
Minto.
Minto. The big dealing they had down there and everything, and they even took a shot at the freighter and so on and so forth. And you read all about what came up there, the conference and everything, the governor and all of them came up and everything. They never used to do that, you know, they didn't pay no attention to an Indian in this country because they weren't organized. But now you take your politician, he's got to have the Indians vote in order to make it, understand? And they want to get all they can get now while they have got that power, because it ain't going to be long until the white man is going to be more white men here, and they ain't going to pay no attention to the Indian vote anymore, understand? And that's what it's coming to. That's what it's coming to. They want to get what they can possibly get now and use this legislation business just as much as they possibly can, because there's going to be a time when their vote ain't going to count at all, now all their politicians are just more than wooing and wooing and wooing the Indian, you know, in order to get their votes. They're organized. They're organizing themselves and so on and so forth. You see. Then the time has come where there's getting to be more and more arguments of the white man about the laws and the things that they're supposed to have and they aren't getting. He started already. The Secretary of the Interior is going back on a lot of things that they have promised them and everything. They've got to go through legislation or go through litigation and things like that there in order to get what they've been promised to them and so on and so forth. It's just making the Indians worse and worse all the time.
Dan, where did you meet your wife?
I met my wife right here in Fairbanks. She was born in Tanana.
I see.
At Tanana. Her father was Burchard, John Burchard, Jack Burchard, big, tall, 6-foot fellow. He used to be at Tanana, and he used to cut cordwood for the ferries and things like that. They have contracts to cut cordwood and stuff for ferries, and then they had fish wheels and so on and so forth. Her mother was all Indian, full Indian, and she's half.
You know, it's really a sad thing that more stories of the Indians of Central Alaska haven't been recorded. If your daughters could work on this project, you know, it would be a good thing. Because Indian stories have not been recorded. You know, they just very few of them are known. And there were a lot of Indian stories. There were stories now that down in Mentasta, when I was down there, one of the men sang a little bit of a song. He said, "This was a song to the Northern Lights," and he said, "But you must keep your thoughts pure and your mind pure and so forth when you sing this song." And he said, "Oh, there are many sacred songs that you must have just the right conditions." And, enough was said that I gathered there's a great deal that we haven't known about the Indian culture.
They make up their stories according to the country and everything else. Now, I remember one very much because the Indian people I'd be taking them with a boat and so forth. And there's a place they called George Crick Hill, or something like that. It's a very dangerous place or something or other. And they would sing this here, and every once in a while they'd 12 Mile Hill, George Crick Hill, and so on, and would come into it, you know, as they sing it. And they every so often they'd repeat that, you know, and then they'd go on, and then they'd repeat that, you know, and so forth. And it's the way their stories are made up from all the surroundings and parks and places.
It'd be about the land and the...
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well... They have a special kind of knowledge that we don't have, that is intimate with the land. And
when they do have their potlatch, they use their handkerchiefs an awful lot. And they'll wind it around like this here, and they'll do this here with it and everything else. It's a scarf, one of their scarves or something. They use their scarf an awful lot for different symbols and so on and so forth when they're dancing.
Though I wonder if those have meaning, those gestures, if they have meaning.
Yeah, I suppose they do. Yes, they very much so. Just the same as your Eskimos, all they have, their guests, all their wontong has a meaning to it. And it's always a meaning to their hunting or their living of some way or other, you know.
Well, Stan, what happened between the time that you left the Shoshana, and you went to Cordova, and then you took the steamer to Anchorage?
Yes, then I lived in Anchorage for about 8 years.
Oh, you did?
And I worked in the fishing business quite a lot. I run boat up and down the inlet. I was the beach boss for the cannery, for Emard's cannery there for a number of years. And I used to have to take care of all the running gear and all the boats and so on and so forth. And then I run boat up and down the inlet and so forth for fish tank centers.
What kind of boats were those?
These here were tenders that we would take out the supplies with to the fishermen and take the fishermen down on the beach and so forth. And then we used these boats to pick up fish that they had caught and bring them back to the cannery, or cannery tenders is what we call them. And these boats is all the way from, 35, 40 to 65 foot length. The boat I run was the Alaska 3, two mast, 65 foot boat. And it was quite a trick the way I got to run this. I worked on the boats a lot. I worked on the boats out of the one summer out of the Seward before I got to Anchorage. I done a lot of mining too. And I worked in the mines in southeastern Alaska at the time. And I hadn't told you about that there. The thing was, when I got out of the Kennecott, before I went back into the mining plant, I left Kennecott. And I went outside to see my folks, and I came back. And on my way back, I stopped at the Juneau and worked at the Juneau mine for a while, and to get more money for my outfits to go back. And we were still getting ready to go back in there and mine, you know, and it took quite a little bit of money to this guy. Well, my partner, Barney McKinney, was still working at Kennecott. He was still in touch, you know, and so on and so forth. And they finally, we got to where we could managed to get back in there, and we got together and went back in again to the Shoshana. Back in the Shoshana.
You went back to the Shoshana a second time then?
No, that was the first time we went back in there, you see.
Oh, I see.
But that wasn't so much interesting to tell or anything like that there, but I could tell you my whole life, you know, from the time I left, everything I had done, but it'd be a long story too, you know. I worked at the Alaska Juneau at that time, in the early days, one of the biggest ball mills in Alaska. And at one time it was a stamp mill, but they had changed it over to a crushing and ball mills and crushers and so on and so forth, and jig tables. And it was one of the biggest operations there was in the, had ever been in gold mining, ever had been known. They mined gold there that run around, 96 cents a ton. Less than a dollar a ton.
Now that's real low grade.
Real low grade. They mined that out of Alaska Juneau there, like you would mine coal out in great big rooms. They wouldn't just stope it. A hard rock mine, they follow a vein. You know, they follow a vein, you stope a vein. Maybe this vein will be 4 feet wide, the white quartz vein. Maybe it'll only be a foot wide, but they got to make the tunnel wide enough so that they can work it. Now, a tunnel is generally made about 6 feet wide, 5 to 6 feet wide, so that they can lay down a track in there and use their ore cars and everything else underground. But the Alaska Juneau wasn't mined that way. They made theirs in a caving system similar to coal mining. They would leave a pillar here and there, a pillar here and there to hold it, and they would just drill in and drill great big rooms and keep drilling and drilling for a month at a time. They would just do nothing but drill and drill. This is a big, big outfit, very big outfit. They bought that stuff out of there in hundreds of millions of tons. And they would drill there for a month, the miners would back in there, and then they would have a powder day. They would have a powder day, and then they'd be hauling powder in. They'd run a railroad back in there. It was 10 cars, and each one of these cars, I think, held around, I don't know just what tonnage. Was it 10 cars they had, and each one of them hauled around 10 tons each, something like that there, and a little engine on them. And they run back into the mine. I ain't sure just which they were. I can't tell you now, but it was something like that. They run this train back into that mine, and they'd fill these up and bring the trains. They're going in and out, two or three trains, you know, one following the other, in and out, and then coming into the mill. Where they come into the mill, they call that the tipple up there. And when they push the car, they push about half their car. No, I think it was pushed four cars at a time, three or four cars at a time into a tipple. Now that tipple is a big, big round cylinder with the tracks going into it like that there, and then they'd uncouple, and then this thing would turn over like that, and it'd have an opening in the top, and it'd all unload, you see. It turned back up, and they'd push another one in and out, and then they got empty, they'd go on out and back into the mine, you see. And they would take and dump that whole train of, it wasn't called just about like that there, one right after another. And anyway, they would take and drill back in there, and for a month, the miners would, you know, and they'd have a blasting day or a powder day, and the trains would be hauling powder back in there, and the miners would be stuffing these holes that they've drilled with powder, with sticks of powder and their primers, and they'd be doing this for quite some time, and then they would have a blasting day, they'd turn these up blasties here, and they'd shake that whole hill. I lived along that mountain there. What was the name of the area that I lived in? But I wasn't very far from them. Maybe I was maybe a half a mile or a mile from the mill itself, up to Juneau. Everything is up on the hill, you know. They had to go up there, and I was up above the town, and one of the places there had a little efficiency apartment like that I stayed in. And they would even shake my windows and everything else when they blasted that thing off. And they'd bring down millions of tons of ore in one blast. They'd bring that all down, and they'd bring it down into pockets, and then they have a big ring there that has a closing. It closes and opens, you know, they do in these chutes and everything, used by air, open. So if these trains run under there while they open it up and just load them right up, you see, and they run right out, and so on and so forth. From the mine, and they run that stuff out of there. They would run millions of tons through that thing in a month's time. You know, they had to a dollar a ton. You know, they were making.
You know, I think that many of the things that men make can in industry are beautiful, and I always loved the sight of that great big mine sprawling across that mountainside. There was a pattern about it. You know, it was. Mm-hmm. It yes. Really was a part of the land in a way. It's all gone now.
I believe. Yeah, that's but that was a great thing. It's too bad that they had to slow it down, but they had to because, well, I worked in there. The first time I worked there, is before I went into the Shushan in the country there, I worked there, I was working, I was operating the ball mill, one of the ball mills. And I was getting around $4.50 a day, I think it was, is what we paid.
How do you operate a ball mill, Stan?
Ball mills are a big metal cylinder. It's real heavy metal, and it's about, in this here place, they're all sides, they can get them all sides, but here, the ball mills here must have been about 14 feet in diameter, 12 to 14 feet in diameter, and about maybe 16 or 16 feet long, something like that. And that's a big metal one called. And that's run by gears, you see, and it's turned over and over and over and over
and
over and over and over and over. Well, now, in the front of that, it's got a scoop. The more ore comes down in there, and you've got a feeder there that you're letting the ore down just at a certain speed, you see, so that this scoop will scoop this ore up. As this cylinder goes around, it scoops this ore up, and it goes into this big ball mill, another big ball mill. Well, then you have balls about so big. They're manganese, hard manganese metal. And they put a whole bunch of these balls in there, and these balls crush this rock and mash it all up, and it comes out the other end very fine, you see. And it goes through another process to get rid of the sand or the rocks or the fine stuff that has been ground all up. And then the gold comes out on tables and different things and shapes, you know, and the gold goes out one way and the one goes the other way because the gold's the heaviest, you know, and so on and so forth. But that ball mill is sort of a grinder, you see, it just grinds up the wind comb. Well, in Alaska Juneau there, they had one floor, they had ball mills, and there was about eight or ten of these ball mills, and you had quite a number of them to operate, and then somebody else had the other number to operate. You had to go back and forth and keep sure that they didn't get plugged up, that the feeders were just feeding out of the bin just a certain way. Well, above them ball mills, there's other crushers that are getting rocks bigger, too big to go into a ball mill. It's got to be crushed again first. Well, right under the main ore bin, up at the tip where they're dumping the cars in. Right under that, there's feeders in there. There's something like a caterpillar track, only they're 6 feet long, and they revolve around underneath the bin there and bring this rock out and dump it into other crushers. So the crushers can be fed just at a certain speed, you see, certain speeds of them crushers. Well, up there, these rocks come out of there as big as pianos and goes into these crushers. These crushers are jaw crushers. Remember, they're the very first crushers that takes the coarse stuff. The very first one is a big, very big jaw crusher. The jaw crusher is about 4 feet in diameter and about 8 feet long. There's one back that is solid. And that has got manganese steel liners onto it, about 4 inches thick and about 2 feet wide, something like that. And you put two of them in there and bolt them in so that they'll stay to save the original back, you see. And then the swinging jaw in front of that there is on a toggle like the one comb, and is run by big belts and an electric motor, you know, a big belt to turn it over and over, and it's swinging this swinging jaw back and forth, back and forth, back and forth like that there, and that rock's going in there and crushing. Well, these swinging jaws are set up to about 8 inches. When we set them up and we let them work until they work themselves back to about 12 to 14 inches. And then we have to stop them down and put some shims in behind the toggle in order to set them back up so they'll be up around 8 inches again, you see. And because them plates that we have on there, the liners we have on there, wear, keep wearing. And when they wear to a certain extent, we take them out. We have a 50-ton crane over us at all times. And we take them out and turn them from end to end so that they can get more on the bottom than they do on the top, you see.
Well, what happened to you at this point? Well, you were running the ball mill.
Well, I run the ball mill the first time I worked there, and I didn't work there too awful long, I don't think it was. And then I don't think I put in more than 3 or 4 months there, and I was trying to get a job over the Chichikov mine. The Chichikov mine is over on the Chichikov Island, and they paid the best money in Alaska. They paid $5 a day on board. And I wanted to get over there if I possibly could, so I could make enough money to get back to my partner and we'd get our outfit and go back into the Shushan and mine gold, you know. Well, I finally left there about 3 months at the Alaska Junot. That's the first time. I worked there twice in Alaska Junot, but I worked there the first time. About 3 months, and I got the job over in the Chichikov. And I had to go underground there, and I went down to the 400 level. That was a mine in a different way. That's a hard rock mine too, but they followed the vein entirely. And the vein laid in about a 45 degree angle in there, and they had tunnels in there, and they had a shaft. Yeah, probably it was steeper than that, 45 probably. Maybe more of a 50 degree or something or other, you know. It was steeper than a 45, but you know, they followed it up the hill or like that there, down there. But they had a shaft that you go down to one level about 100 feet to another 100 feet to another level and so on. And they're called tunnels. Them are called tunnels. Each one of them are tunnels and levels. First level, second level, third level, fourth level, down to the 10th level. I think they were down 11. Well, this shaft goes all the way down and services them all, and then it brings ore up too, you know, and dumps it in to go to the mill and so forth. Well, this mining here, I worked over there in this mine, and I worked down the 400, and I was a tramway fellow. The cars down there was run by hand, by gravity, because they were they laid their track in a very small car. They hauled about a yard of rock at a time into them. And you run them underneath a wooden chute and open up a wooden tunnel and let the stuff out of the stope. They're stoping. The miners are working up between this level and the other level. What they call a stope. They're setting up their water liners and their drills and things, and they're drilling up into this here vein, drilling up into this vein to shoot it, you see. And when they load it with powder and shoot, it comes right down into this chute, you see. And my car comes to there, and I load them up, and I let it go down to the pocket or down to the shaft and unload it down there in the pocket where the skip can come down that shaft and get a load and haul it up, you see, and everything. Well, I could load it up and I could ride it down. I would put a piece of drilling steel in on the wheels there, and I'd stand on the back and have my hand on my wooden comb on the steel for a brake. And we'd ride down. And I'd dump my car, and then I'd push it all the way back up to get another load. I'd push it way back up into the tunnel, probably quite a ways, and so forth. I worked there at the Chichikov. I worked there at the Chichikov for, a year, I guess, at the Chichikov mine, underground. I'd never go underground ever again. I tell you, that was miserable, soft and wet and everything else, and it was warm and hot down there as can be, and such. And, yeah, there were shoot packs on all the time, you feed yourself. I never worked underground again. That's my last underground work.
I think that fishing business on Cook Inlet might have been kind of interesting.
Anyway, I went back to, after I got out of and come back to Anchorage, I went to work at the on the railroad. And I was firing crane around the yard, and then I got the job of firing ditcher. That's a big steam shovel out on the railroad, and that goes along the ditch and the right-of-way up and so on and so forth, and cleaning it along the way with the rocks that slough down during the winter and so on and so forth. And I worked for the railroad quite some time, and then there was changing hands there, changing men. The head man, the superintendent of the railroad, was sent in here by the government. Colonel Olson was taken over, and he was just going to make that railroad really pay efficiently, you know, lay them off here and lay them off there. And I knew I didn't have no seniority to amount to anything. So I just took a 90-day leave, before they caught up to me and fired me or sort of laid me off. And I went back to Alaska Junot to get a job. And now things were getting a little bit tough. People were coming to Alaska quite a bit at that time now. And things were getting rather rough. And I got down there to get a job to Alaska Junot. There was 200 or 300 men waiting to get a job, lined up outside there and everything. You couldn't even get through them to get to the office to see about a job. Well, I had in the meantime learned to be a welder and so on and so forth. And I worked around the shops there at the railroad, and You know, I a welder of 10 days was worth his weight in gold to these people, because you repair the piece of machinery right there and right then and there, where they had to take weeks and weeks to send it out by boat and so on. It wasn't like an airplane today, you just go right out and come back and so on and so forth with the piece. Take weeks and weeks, and without that piece of machinery or something going, why, the place would be down and it wouldn't be landing and making money. Anyway, I could never get to the button cone, so I went back up, and I was pretty smart anyway. I just always figured I was awful smart. I called the office. I understand that you're looking for a welder down there. I didn't know what they were or what they weren't. Until they started talking to me, you know, and everything, and it says, come on down and have a talk with them, interview them, and everything. So I got down there and I just had to wait for the men to get in there and everything. When I got in there, they gave me a job right away. And I soon what I'd done and so on and so forth. And when I come back out, I almost got mobbed by these people because I had a ticket and I was going to work. Funny thing, you know. And this time I went up, I was working up on the in the course crusher department. And I worked there long enough to got to be one of the ship bosses. I had one of the night shift. About a dozen men in there, and I had welders and everything else on them, and I got to running the crane. And I'll tell you how I got to running the crane too. I was working in the gang, you know, and one time I kept watching that guy up there on the wall, you know, on that crane back and forth and doing this and that, and you know, how he's working an electric outfit, you know, he's just going to go this way, and one to go that way, and so on and so forth, you know. And one day crane man didn't show up, and they had to have this crane. And the ship boss, it was ship boss of me at the time, you know, he says, "Shorty, you can run that crane, can't you?" I said, "Sure I can." And that crane pulled my life. I went up there, I run it, you blame me, don't think I didn't. And anyway, I had to pick up a great big motor, great big electric motor, something about so big, you know, to use for driving those big crushers, you know, and move it from here down to the other end of the building. And I knew all about that crane, sure as a dickens, you know. It got me over it. I finally got over it, let the hook down, and they hooked me onto it, and I raised it up, and I started off down the, wasn't going just as big as a pea, you know. That button cone hook and everything was a little swinging this way. He got me over it. I finally got over it, let the hook down, and they hooked me onto it, and I raised it up, and I started off down the button cone just as big as a pea, you know. That button cone hook and everything was a little swinging this way and that way, because I didn't know how to run that crane and keep my load right under me, you know. There's a system to it, you know. I got down there and it got stopped, that pendulum got stopped and everything. And not so that I could let it down and make it sit on the bed where they wanted it, you know. When I come back down, the boy says, "I thought you said you could run that crane." I said, "I did, didn't I?" "Yeah, dude, I thought you were going to knock the wall down with it." But anyway, I got to be one of the best crane operators they ever had.
So you kept on running it, and you learned how to do it.
And they immediately took me from one, they had one of them cranes on front of every floor to handle their big stuff, you know. And they would take me from one floor to the other to run the crane when they were really stuck and it was in a hurry, you know. Take the other crane man off, put me on because I could get it back into shape and into care, and a lot of things were particular and so forth, and I was just absolutely their crane man. I could take that crane and I could just pick their teeth with it.
It's just a fine sense of precision.
Well, you see, the way you travel with your hook, you know, you travel with your hook right along with you, and when you get there, it's dead. You don't swing at all, you know. There's a way of doing it. You have to.
Well, now.
It's the same way with any one of these.
You've done so many things, Stan. How did you get in the fishing business?
Well, I'll put another one. I had lots of nerve and pretty darn smart. And
it shows.
Anyway, I had worked on boats before, you know. I worked on the boats around them as a deckhand, a mechanic and engineer and deckhand, and so forth. I never piloted one, but I'd have to take the wheel ever so often to relieve my the pilot, you know, and so forth. And I worked around boats offshore in the fishing business for a while, one season, I guess it was, around Kodiak in that way. And then I came to Anchorage and I got a job, I guess, after the winter was over on at the Emard Cannery on what they called the, what's the name of that little boat? I can't think of it. Joe Tandler was the captain. It was a two-man boat. Him and me was on it. It was a purse-seining boat, and he was used for a tender and so forth. But anyway, Joe Tanzer was a little older person than I was, but he was quite a drinking man, an awful drinking man, fine fellow to be with, no matter if he was drunk or whether he was, it didn't make any difference. And I would have to take the wheel quite a lot. He'd get the boat away from the dock, but after that he hit the bed, you know, and I'd have to handle the boat, you know, and so on and so forth, and that went down. But when I would get down to some of the tricky places to get into, among the rocks and so forth, going into one of the fishing sites where the scow was to tie up to take on fish or to let off gear or something or other, why, I would rouse him and he'd take over, you know. And I got to where I could go into these places myself, you know, too, as far as that goes, you know. But anyway, one season there, I guess it was, that a friend of mine, we were together and another thing, and we were kind of kidding each other and so on and so forth, and there's another cannery besides the Emard Cannery there called McGill's Cannery. And we were going to go down there and see about getting a job. And on the way down, we got to kidding each other, you know, and so forth. They said, well, I'll ask for the captain's job, I said, skipper's job, and he'll ask for the engineer's job. Okay. And like a dang fool, I didn't, and I got the job. Anyway, they had a boat, the Alaska 3, that they had chartered from Diamond Kid. Diamond Kid is one of the fellows uptown, he's kind of a bootlegger and a gambler and so on and so forth, and he acquired this Alaska fleet through some way or another. And he had it leased out to this cannery, McGill's Cannery. And I says to him, I hired out from home and they told me about it. Well, I says, it's all right. I says, I'll run the wind pump, but it's all right with the man that owns the boat. So I went up to Diamond Kid, and they took me right up there, and the skipper was here, and so on and so forth. And Diamond Kid says, all right with me, you got the boat, you should be responsible for it. I run the boat. I run the boat. I don't mean maybe. But anyway, the fellow that I was with, he didn't get the engineer job, because they had an engineer job. And the engineer was Charlie Hubbard, and he was another hard drinking. All these fishermen are hard drinkers anyway, and boatmen and so on and so forth, you know. Well, then that was right down my alley too, but he was a good engine man. Charlie was a good boatman, a good engine man, and he was a great help to me, because I would protect him all times, you know, for each job too. You do when you're with people, with all like that, you know, be cutting somebody's throat or anything. And it just worked out just fine.
So where did you go to fish?
Well, we didn't do no fishing. All we were was a tender.
You were a tender.
We were a tender.
Yes.
And we took them down the inlet, down to the Tyonic and the Cuscatan Flats and so on, all the way down to Kenai, and across on the Alaska Peninsula and over on the Kenai Peninsula, all up and down from Anchorage all the way down to Kenai and back on that side, and then over on the other side, all the way down past the Susitna, Tyonic, and all along through that part of the country. And,
did you get down?
We had fishermen in different locations, you know, all up and down the inlet there them days.
Now, were the men that you were hauling this fish from, were they any of them seining on the beach, or were they all out in boats?
Well, some of them did. We had seiners that were king salmon fishermen, and we took them down in a certain place where the kings, where they could seine from the beach for kings. And then we had hand traps, what they called hand traps in them days. That's against the law now for hand traps. There was hand traps in them days and also driven traps, big piling driven traps that were driven in deep water, where we're deep water all the time. But there at the inlet, in the inlet, the tide runs out so far and everything, and back, and there are big tides and everything. They used the hand traps. The tide would go way out. We had locations, different locations, many locations all the way down the inlet there where we had hand traps. The cannery furnished them the poles and the stakes and the chicken wire and everything else to build this trap out into the ocean. When the tide on the low tide, when the real low tide was running way, big minus tide, run way out, why the fisherman, he would get out there and he'd drive these pegs and they'd drive them down in the wind coast as far as he can drive them, you know, here and there, here and there, here and there, to make a lead and make his heart out there for the trap. I don't just know just how they did it or anything of the kind, but I know the system as it works and everything. But this lead comes from the shore out there, and then the pot is made so that the fish comes into this lead, they'll go out and get into this pot, you see. Well, they drive these stakes about so high, and then we'd bring the big long poles down there that would be higher than the tide when it comes in. The small poles would be cut for the canny especially. And we'd haul them down there and unload them on their scow for them so that they could get them. The scow is anchored offshore where the water is deep at all times, you see, and it's anchored there and it stays right there. That's their supply scow that they'll throw their fish on, and we'll come up to it later on and load the fish on and count them and take them in and give them credit for their fish and take them to the cannery and then bring them more supplies they needed. Well, they would take it and tie these big long poles onto these wind comb and string their chicken wire across onto it and make this big trap. That's what they call a hand trap, you see. And then they didn't have any drift fishing at them times up and down the inlet at all, because it was all hand traps, and then there was gill netting that they gill netted for kings over on the Alaska side, the Alaska Peninsula side now in the Kuskokwim.
Gee, there were sure a lot of different kinds of people doing a lot of different kinds of work. Did you ever run into Bob and Charlie Matheson down there in the inlet?
Matheson.
The Matheson brothers, they had come up...
They sound pretty familiar to me.
Matheson. They were over at a place called Chickaloon. Their father had come to Hope. They came up as boys in the 1890s with their dad to Hope. And then they had wound up building a little outfit on this Chickaloon River, which came down on the into Cook in the Turnagain Arm there. Mm-hmm. And I met them in the 40s, or 49-50. I was writing for radio along and then and got involved with doing a story there. Anyway, they had a barge. They were hauling fish, scow. They were hauling fish for Emards. Mm-hmm. But in the winter they trapped, and they were just a real interesting pair of brothers, you know.
Anyway, we asked that they get out and get our meat and our moose and so forth in the fall and everything like that there. And we used to cut our own wood, go out and cut the wood 16 feet long and so forth and have it hauled in and have it sawed up as every wood in the town and so forth like that there if you lived in town and such. But anyway, 1 year, you got your bug on?
Yeah.
1 year, me and another fellow, we were going to go hunting up the 20 Mile River. Now that's going up the arm, and Chickaloon is over on the other side of it and so forth, and we had a 30-foot river boat, and me and him had our stuff in there to go out and go hunting, you know, in camp, and we were going up the 20 Mile River. We got down to the 20 Mile River, and we started up the river with our motor. We had an outboard motor. We went as far as our motor could go, and then we had to get out and line our boat from there on up. One man would stay on the shore as best he could over close to the shore, right opposite the boat, and hold the boat off into the stream with a pole, with a long pole, and the other fellow would have a long line, and he'd be up ahead pulling the boat. But he would hold the boat out while you pulled it along, and you line your boat for miles and miles like that, and you get way up the 20 Mile to the forks. And we got up into the forks, one fork and one stream went over to one glacier and one went over to another glacier like that there, and we camped right in the middle of the forks. Well, we got there and there was one of the fellows that was a fireman on the railroad, and another fellow with him, I don't know, he worked for the railroad, I guess, too, or something or other, and they didn't have no bowling, but they had gotten them moose, and they'd back there hunting, and they wanted to borrow our boat and take their moose down, and they would bring it back. It'd be quite a job to bring it back, but they promised they would bring it back to us. Now they went, we let them have it, like Alaskans are, you know, and everything. And in the meantime, they were gone, and they never did bring our boat back, you know, brought it back or anything else. But it started to snow and rain back there. We got our moose and everything later on, but we didn't get it then. But. And it snowed and snowed until, by golly, it was about 18 inches of snow, right from the bottom of here, clear up. How much it got on that mountain, went up in there, I don't know. But anyway, it melted and rained and melted. It was a big flood. And we had a cabin there. This was just a little small cabin printer with a flat roof onto it. Didn't mount it much at all. I don't think it was more than 7 feet high or anything of the kind. And you know, we had to get our stuff out and get it up on that roof of that cabin, and that doggone water come within the 2 feet of the top of that one. Well, I thought we were going to wash our cabin away. I don't know how it ever didn't. It must have been taking roots to the ground or something. And we had to wait there and wait there for a long time. That must have been about 6 or 7 days or 8 days for it to go down so that we could get out of there. Well, then we had gotten our moose and everything.
Stan, did you live on top of the cabin during
that
2 days?
Yes.
You cooked and slept and everything on top of the
cabin?
No,
no, we ever done any cooking. Ate what we could eat.
Yeah, whatever you had to do, there you were.
Anyway, we went back. They never did bring our boat back. Oh, we were mad. Oh, we were a couple of mad but we were cheap then, guys, when we got them. We hadn't got cooled off by the time we got caught up with them, we probably shot them.
And you did catch up with them then?
No. We got down that one called. We had made a raft and put our moose onto it, and we made it down to the railroad with it. And the freight train come along, it would stop anywhere from there, you know, pick you up. So, and we unloaded our boat, loaded our moose and everything in one of the flat cars, or one of the box cars there, and went into Hanks. Well, we never run on to this guy, but we run on to him later on, and boy, did we talk to him.
Whatever had happened to your boat?
He took our boat and took it all the way to Hanks. Never did bring it back. Never intended to bring it back.
Wasn't that terrible?
Isn't that an awful way people do?
Boy, that doesn't happen too often, does it?
No. Then another time, I was taking out a hunter in the guide business. You didn't have to have guide license in them days at all, but you'd get someone that would pay you to go out to hire you, they'd take you and everything. So I was over in the Susitna country, and going up the little Susitna. Over on the Susitna flats, the tide runs way out there, and it's all mud. The mud is clear up, you get out of your boat, you get in the mud, clear up to the waist into that the country. And the tide runs way up into the 30 miles back up to the little Susitna. Runs way back up in there. Well, you go in on the tide, you go in on the tide and go up in there. And we went back up in there about 75 miles to the little Susitna. And me and the fellow I had out got to our game, and it was late in the fall. And I got up in the morning and I seen the slush and stuff coming down, soft slush coming down the creek. Well, I says to him, I says, we've got to get out of here. I says, tomorrow morning that stuff's going to be hard chunks coming down there. I says, so we'll pile up and pack up and get out of here. So we went down, and we went down within about 30 miles from where the tide comes in, you know. And here were some fellows that I knew from town that they were hunting on their own, and they were camped there. And the ice was gathering up and freezing along the banks, even then, at that time, to some extent. Well, I went ashore, and I was going to stay there until the tide came in and go out on the tide then, you see, so I wouldn't get into them flaps out there. So I went ashore and stayed with them. Well, we stayed there, and they says they would wait till the next morning and we'd all go out together. They'd go along with us, you know, and with me. Well, in the meantime, it snowed a little bit, you know, about so much on income, and I didn't have nothing else to do, so I went hunting again. I went off out in the woods, and the snow disappeared. I didn't pay no attention to where I was going or nothing of the kind, you know. And I got ready to come back. I couldn't follow my tracks back, you know, and I thought, well, I'll just start off back to the river. And you know, in this country here, the old thing is that your sloughs run parallel to your... There's lots of them that are round, you know, but a lot of them run lengthwise. They run parallel to the river. So you just keep crossing them, you'll come to the river. I knew that. And so that's the way I was doing, you know. It was timbered, brushy country. Oh, it was the most brushy country. Even the Indians get lost back then. You never see them again. Well, I kept traveling, and I never come to the river. And I'd only had a sandwich with me. And I didn't have too many shells with me, and I didn't want to waste them. I was getting in a bad position. And I'd climb a tree, and I'd look, and I said, that's river timber over there. I'd get down, I'd travel through the woods, and I'd climb another tree, and I'd river timber over there, that's river timber. I could see way over there, and I didn't know that that's river timber. Down I'd travel again, and you know, I was out there that day, that night, the next day, and the next night. But finally, I was getting pretty all in, you know. I'd sit with my back up against a tree and sleep a little bit at night, you know, until daylight again and you come so I could travel. And I knew that I must be doing something wrong, because I knew that that was a river that I should be coming to it and could get to it. So I started with my hunting knife, and I kept blazing, and kept them blazing behind me and straight, and I came out to the river. But I don't know whether I was above, I figured that I was above the camp, above them, you know, the camp somewhere, but I didn't know how far exactly. But where I came out, I was about 50, there was a mud bank there, and about 50 feet down to the creek, to the little creek. Boy, that was certainly a relief when I come to the river, because I knew I would make it out all right then, but I sat down, I was just all tired out, you know, and I sat there for a while, really. And pretty soon I heard a put, 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 put of the motor. They'd been out looking for me, you see, and they were upriver. I didn't know whether they were down or whether, but boy, I got up, and when I seen that boat come around the bend and come down towards me, boy, I come down off of that bank, that 50-foot mud bank, head over heels. I'm telling you that I could. They picked me up, put me in that boat, and I went out like a light. They said I was just as white as a sheet. They poured a pint of whiskey down on me, and I couldn't bring it to them. It was such a relief. They took me down to the camp and packed me out of the boat before I came to. I thought I really had it. That's a great grizzly bear country, big ones too. And Indians have been lost in there, and they've been killed by bears and everything else. You have all that on your mind, and you're lost, you know. And I was lost.
Boy, well, you had a right to pass out.
Well, anyway, it was too late to go out when I came to and everything, and I got something in, and they had heat, and so on and so forth. And I told these fellows, I said, now the ice over them times, it formed to beat the dickens, and as the river comes around like this here, it'll form in the bites. The ice will form in this bite, it'll be clear water over here in this other bite. And then you get around the other side, well, there'll be ice over in the other bites, you know, and clear water on this side, and so on and so forth. But we were in this bite here, and it all formed hard ice in there and everything else, you know, all chopped up and hard and frozen right together like, you know, and so on and so forth. And my boat was against the shore. Well, I told him, I says, now, we're going to get out of here, you've got to get out of here. But I says, the thing to do, the only way you can ever get out of here, I says, is with the boats, is to take it and do the same as I do, I say. Get out into that stream, right straight out into that, and don't start going down along that windcomb, because you'll never make it, and you'll be stuck. But get out of there as fast as you can. And I told the man that I had with me to take that little bit of axe and get up there in the bow, and just keep chopping, and I says, and I'll get this motor to go, and we'll push you right out into the stream as fast as we can get, right straight out, I says, that's where we want to go. And I got out into the water. And they didn't make it. I looked back, and they didn't make it. So I couldn't come back to the shore there, so I had to go run around the point of ways, and then come back so I could get in contact. And in the meantime,